Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Half of the room from my bed.
Oh.
They are good at sound insulation. All right, here we go. Yeah, okay.
Yep. Hello, I'm Amy Scott, filling in today for Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
And I'm Sabri Benishore, in for Kai Rizdahl for the rest of the week. Thank you for joining us for What Do You Know? Wait, What Do You Want to Know? Wednesday. I'm sorry, I'm still new. What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? The day we answer your questions. And here is our first one.
Hi, this is Lee from Huntsville, Alabama. We are the Rocket City because we had Wernher von Braun's team sending men to the moon. My question is about interest rates. The Fed upped the interest rate 0.25%, but mortgage rates went up a lot more than 0.25%. And so I'm wondering how that worked, why the mortgage rate doesn't follow the Fed rate more closely. Please make me smart. Thank you.
What a good question.
Oh, this is a great question. Yeah, I love this. And honestly, it took me like a while as a housing reporter to really figure this out. So I actually did a story about this last month we can link to. What the Fed controls, as Sabri well knows from covering finance, is something called the federal funds rate. It's the rate that banks charge each other overnight to lend each other money. That's super short term. Mortgages, you know, you get a mortgage for 15, 30 years. Most people hold on to their mortgage, though, for maybe 10 years, give or take. So it more closely follows the 10-year Treasury note. And those interest rates are really set by investors and how much they want to be compensated for loaning the federal government money for 10 years. And those rates, yields, they call them in the bond market, have been going up in advance of the Fed's moves, partly because they were kind of pricing in what they expected the Fed to do, which is to make money more expensive. But also with inflation, you know, they're looking at prices going up, their money's not going to be worth as much, and so they want to be paid more. And so that's why we saw mortgage rates going up before the Fed even started tightening and are expected to see that continue to happen.
There's just like a whole bunch of other factors piled on there. It's not just the Fed funds rate. It like equals mortgage rate plus something. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on, basically.
Yeah, right. And then there's other stuff like, you know, depending on the mortgage lender you call, you're going to get a very different quote. And it can be as much as like the rent that they pay on their fancy office downtown or what their quota is that week. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this. There's also the whole market for mortgage-backed securities, which plays into this. It's more complicated than what I just said. But the bottom line is, yeah, don't expect that to too closely follow what the Fed does, although it is related. Because what the Fed does control kind of the cost overall of borrowing money, and it filters throughout the economy.
Makes sense? I hope makes sense to me. I hope one day to be in a position to have a mortgage, but you know, New York housing costs.
Yeah, you come to Baltimore. we've got bargains here. All right, up next, we've got a question about interest rates with a slightly different focus.
Hi, my name is Todd, calling from Astoria, New York. My question is, when the Fed decides to raise their interest rates to cool the economy, they must think that the economy can take that hit without contracting. So why don't banks and credit cards just raise their rates independently when they think the economy is strong? Thanks for making me smart.
Right. Okay. So Yes, banks and credit cards can set their own interest rates, but they tend to kind of be the same. We actually asked Rodney Rumcharan, a finance professor at USC's Marshall School of Business, about this, and he was saying that banks and credit card companies want to keep their rates about what their competitors are charging, or they're going to lose customers. So if a bank like raised, you know, its rates just on its own, I mean, what do you think is going to happen? Everyone else is, you know, their customers are just going to be like, screw you. I'm going to the next one, you know, even though they might get some people wanting to open savings account, but it's not worth it for them. It's almost, you know, it's like a marketplace, you know, they don't want to lose customers to their competitors. They're not going to, they're not going to just shoot themselves in the foot unnecessarily unless they absolutely have to. If that makes sense.
Makes sense to me. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. They do have a little bit of leeway, but it's funny how one rate goes up and you see, like, right down the line, others follow suit.
Yeah. Yesterday, Amy, you did a deep dive on this show into the economics of refugees, and we have a question related to that.
Hi, Make Me Smart hosts. My name is Hannah, and my question is, are refugees frequently resettled in relatively smaller, remote areas? And if so, why? I'm asking because my parents and grandparents were Soviet refugees in the late 70s, early 80s, and they were placed in New Orleans by Hayas, which is where they met. But really shortly after, my family moved up to New York City. And that's where we've been since. So I'm wondering, do the agencies place in places like New York directly or nah? Thanks.
If you missed that, she said, I'm wondering, do the agencies place in places like New York City or nah? That's an interesting question. She's talking about HIAS, which is the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. It's a Jewish American nonprofit that provides refugee assistance actually all over the world. I spoke to them recently for a story, one of the nine resettlement agencies here in the U.S. And, you know, we couldn't answer that question ourselves, so we went back to the economics professor, Ramya Vijaya, that we talked to, and asked her that question. Here's what she had to say.
The choice of where to resettle refugees depends on a few different criteria. For example, refugees may have family connections in some place in the U.S. In that case, they may be resettled closer to that place. Resettlement also depends primarily on the capabilities that the resettlement agencies have been able to build up over the years. Some agencies also specialize in some special needs for refugees, perhaps medical needs, or if they have children and they have been able to mobilize more childcare resources within the community. Currently, New York, Texas, and California are the top refugee-receiving states. But as I mentioned, as different agencies build up their capacities, these might change.
And Sabri, we talked yesterday a little bit about Erie, Pennsylvania, you know, where Marketplace has done quite a lot of reporting. It's a big draw, place for refugees. And I think part of that is they've had a decline in population because of the loss of their industrial, base. And when you develop that reputation and the network that goes along with it, you become a good place to attract more refugees. And actually, there's a significant Ukrainian population there. I wouldn't be surprised if we see more folks come in this new wave from the war.
Yeah, you know, the older I get, the more amazed I am to really think about what it takes for refugees, or I mean, frankly, you know, many immigrants to, you know, come here and start over, like completely over, you know, I don't know. Moving to New York was hard enough, you know, like it's just wild. It's just wild.
Yeah. And the trauma and we talked yesterday about the economics of resettlement and just how quickly people tend to fall into jobs and contribute to the economy. And I'm just thinking they're doing this on top of you know, tremendous trauma and difficulty, you know, with the possibility of never going home. It really is amazing and sad.
Yeah.
All right, this next one is an email from Jennifer in Pittsburgh, and I'm going to read this. She asks, "Hi, Make Me Smart. I'd like to know how Elon Musk got to be the richest man in the world. He seems like just a marketing guy and hype man who makes a lot of money when he sells stocks after driving up the price with outrageous tweets. What am I missing?" Sabri, this is all you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that might be his hobby, you know, like some of us have plants or like play Wordle, but I think Elon's hobby is just messing with the stock
companies.
Market on Twitter. Yeah. But yeah, no, he is the, you know, according to Forbes, he's the richest person in the world. I mean, the short answer is that a lot of his wealth comes from owning Tesla stock, and Tesla stock has just skyrocketed over the years, like 33%. You know, part of it is also he beat out the competition. So Jeff Bezos, you know, who started Amazon, Amazon's stock price it dropped a little. Plus, Bezos gave away some money to charity, so he fell to number two. What a loser, falling to number two. number two, richest man on the planet. The longer answer is that, well, A, he comes from a family with resources. So, I mean, he started with that. His mom was a model, a former Miss South Africa finalist. His dad was Errol Musk, was an engineer and a pilot. And part owner of an emerald mine in Zambia. So, you know, he's not
that
coming
helps.
From nothing here. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's been building his wealth through startups for a while, internet startups, tech startups. His first one was this thing called Zip2, which he founded with his brother. They sold software for online city guides and newspapers. And that company was sold by, was sold for $300 million. So that was a little nice start. He's done so much more since then. I mean, you know, he sold another company for $22 million, this online banking startup. An online banking startup that merged with another company and became PayPal. You might know PayPal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You may have heard of
him. Yeah. So, I mean, he had to leave PayPal, but when eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion, Elon Musk walked away with $180 million. So, you know, he took that. He invested that in SpaceX. He invested that in Tesla. And, you know, SpaceX is, you know, got up like billions in contracts from NASA. Tesla went public, raised more than $200 million in its IPO. So you put all that together, plus how much Tesla stock has grown, and, you know, he's pretty damn rich. So
he's done a lot,
easy, really.
But you got to wonder if he hasn't hurt himself at times with his behavior, you know? I mean, he's gotten in trouble with the SEC and, you know, clearly he's building wealth, but I wonder if he also is chipping away at it at times.
Yeah. You know, I feel like it takes a certain kind of, well, I shouldn't say that it takes a certain kind of personality to build these kinds of businesses, but I don't know. I feel like the personality traits that contribute to that also can be disruptive sometimes. You know, I mean, like, if you think about people you even know, like, you know, sometimes people who are great at business are not great at dinner, you know?
Right, or great at people.
You know,
yeah.
People, yeah.
Okay. I think that's all the questions we have time for today. But those were really great. Thank you for sending them. Thanks for listening. I will be out tomorrow, but back on Friday. Sabri will be here for the rest of the week, filling in for Kai.
Yep, I will hopefully be back tomorrow doing the news to make me smile with Marielle Segarra. So keep sending us your questions for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. You can email us. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART.
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera and Marquet Green, with production help from our intern, Tiffany Bowie.
Today's show was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado, Ben Tolliday, and Daniel Ramirez, composed our theme music. And our senior producer is Bridget Bodner.
Borders Greenhouse Edition. Still laughing at that one.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.